The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. Copyright 1971 by Ursula K. Le Guin. This unabridged recording of the reading of The Lathe of Heaven was published by arrangement with Charles Scribner's Sons, a division of Simon & Schuster, and was produced in 1997 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Susan O'Malley. This book is 175 pages long. The Lathe of Heaven by Ursula K. Le Guin. The following material appears on the book's back cover. If dreams could change the world, a dreamer could destroy it. George Orr's dreams do change the world. He is the only one who knows it. He and the power-mad psychiatrist who is forcing George to dream a new reality, a better reality, free from war, disease, overpopulation, and all human misery. But for every man-made dream of utopia, there is a terrifying, unforeseeable consequence. And George must dream and dream again, forever seeking a perfect future, until the very essence of cosmic reality begins to disintegrate. The Lathe of Heaven is perhaps the finest, most eerily provocative novel from an author who is world-renowned for the dramatic force of her vision. Chapter 1. Confucius and you are both dreams. And I, who say you are dreams, am a dream myself. This is a paradox. Tomorrow, a wise man may explain it. That tomorrow will not be for 10,000 generations. Zhuang Zi, 2. Current-borne, wave-flung, tugged hugely by the whole might of ocean, the jellyfish drifts in the tidal abyss. The light shines through it. And the dark enters it, born, flung, tugged, from anywhere to anywhere. For in the deep sea there is no compass, but nearer and farther, higher and lower. The jellyfish hangs and sways, pulses move slight and quick within it, as the vast diurnal pulses beat in the moon-driven sea. Hanging, swaying, pulsing, the most vulnerable and insubstantial creature. It has for its defense the violence and power of the whole ocean, to which it has entrusted its being, its going, and its will. But here rise the stubborn continents. The shelves of gravel and the cliffs of rock break from water baldly into air, that dry, terrible outer space of radiance and instability, where there is no support for life. And now the currents mislead and the waves betray, breaking their endless circle to leap up in loud foam against rock and air, breaking. What will the creature made all of sea drift do on the dry sand of daylight? What will the mind do each morning, waking? His eyelids had been burned away so that he could not close his eyes, and the light entered into his brain. Searing. He could not turn his head, for blocks of fallen concrete pinned him down, and the steel rods projecting from their cores held his head in a vice. When these were gone, he could move again. He sat up. He was on the cement steps. A dandelion flowered by his hand, growing from a little cracked place in the steps. After a while, he stood up, but as soon as he was on his feet, he felt deathly sick, and knew it was the radiation sickness. The door was only 2 feet from him, for the balloon bed, when inflated, half filled his room. He got to the door and opened it and went through it. There stretched the endless linoleum corridor, heaving slightly up and down for miles, and far down it, very far, the men's room. He started out toward it, trying to hold on to the wall, but there was nothing to hold on to, and the wall turned into the floor. "Easy now, easy there." The elevator guard's face was hanging above him like a paper lantern, pallid, fringed with graying hair. "It's the radiation," he said, but Manny didn't seem to understand, saying only, "Take it easy." He was back on his bed in his room.
"You drunk?"
"No."
"High on something?"
"Sick."
"What have you been taking?"
"Couldn't find the fit," he said, meaning that he had been trying to lock the door through which the dreams came, but none of the keys had fit the lock.
"Medic's coming up from the 15th floor," Manny said faintly through the roar of breaking glass.
He was floundering and trying to breathe. A stranger was sitting on his bed holding a hypodermic and looking at him.
"That did it," the stranger said. "He's coming round. Feel like hell? Take it easy. You ought to feel like hell. Take all this at once?"
He displayed seven of the little plastifoil envelopes from the auto drug dispensary.
"Lousy mixture, barbiturates and dexedrine. What were you trying to do to yourself?"
It was hard to breathe, but the sickness was gone, leaving only an awful weakness.
"They're all dated this week," the medic went on, a young man with a brown ponytail and bad teeth. "Which means they're not all off your own pharmacy card, so I've got to report you for borrowing. I don't like to, but I got called in and I haven't any choice, see? But don't worry. With these drugs, it's not a felony. You'll just get a notice to report to the police station, and they'll send you up to the med school or the area clinic for examination, and you'll be referred to an MD or a shrink for VTT, voluntary therapeutic treatment. I filled out the form on you already, used your ID. All I need to know is how long you've been using these drugs and more than your personal allotment." "Couple months."
The medic scribbled on a paper on his knee.
"And who'd you borrow the farm cards from?"
"Friends."
"Gotta have the names."
After a while, the medic said,
"One name, anyhow, just a formality. It won't get him in trouble. See, they'll just get a reprimand from the police, and HEU control will keep a check on the farm cards for a year. Just a formality. One name."
"I can't. They were trying to help me."
"Look, if you won't give the names, you're resisting, and you'll either go to jail or get stuck into obligatory therapy in an institution. Anyway, they can trace the cards through the auto drug records if they want to. This just saves them time. Come on, just give me one of the names."
He covered his face with his arms to keep out the unendurable light and said,
"I can't. I can't do it. I need help." "He borrowed my card," the elevator guard said. "Yeah, Manny Ahrens, 247-602-6023.
The medic's pen went scribble, scribble.
"I never used your card." "So confuse them a little. They won't check. People use people's farm cards all the time. They can't check. I loan mine, use another cat's all the time. Got a whole collection of those reprimand things. They don't know. I've taken things HEW never even heard of. You ain't been on the hook before. Take it easy, George."
"I can't," he said, meaning that he could not let Manny lie for him, could not stop him from lying for him, could not take it easy, could not go on.
"You'll feel better in 2-3 hours, the medic said, "but stay in today. Anyhow, downtown's all tied up. The GPRT drivers are trying another strike, and the National Guard's trying to run the subway trains, and the news says it's one hell of a mess. Stay put. I got to go. I walk to work, damn it, 10 minutes from here. That state housing complex down on McAdam."
The bed jounced as he stood up.
"You know, there's 260 kids in that one complex suffering from kwashiorkor. All low-income or basic support families, and they aren't getting protein. And what the hell am I supposed to do about it? I've put in 5 different recs for minimal protein ration for those kids, and they don't come. It's all red tape and excuses. People on basic support can afford to buy sufficient food, they keep telling me. Sure, but what if the food isn't there to buy? Oh, the hell with it. I go give them vitamin C shots and try to pretend that starvation is just scurvy."
The door shut. The bed jounced when Manny sat down on it, where the medic had been sitting. There was a faint smell, sweetish, like newly cut grass.
Out of the darkness of closed eyes, the mist rising all around, Manny's voice said remotely, "Ain't it great to be alive?"
Chapter 2. The portal of God is non-existence. Zhuangzi, 23. Dr. William Haber's office did not have a view of Mount Hood. It was an interior efficiency suite on the 63rd floor of Willamette East Tower and didn't have a view of anything. But on one of the windowless walls was a big photographic mural of Mount Hood, and at this Dr. Haber gazed while intercommunicating with his receptionist.
"Who's this Orr coming up, Penny? The hysteric with leprosy symptoms?"
She was only 3 feet away through the wall, but an interoffice communicator, like a diploma on the wall, inspires confidence in the patient as well as in the doctor, and it is not seemly for a psychiatrist to open the door and shout, "Next!"
"No, doctor, that's Mr. Green tomorrow at 10. This is the referral from Dr. Waters at the University Medical School, a VTT case."
"Drug abuse, right. Got the file here. Okay, send him in when he comes."
Even as he spoke, he could hear the elevator whine up and stop, the doors gasp open, then footsteps, hesitation, the outer door opening. He could also, now he was listening, hear doors, typewriters, voices, toilets flushing, in offices all up and down the hall, and above him and underneath him. The real trick was to learn how not to hear them. The only solid partitions left were inside the head. Now, Penny was going through the first visit routine with the patient, and while waiting, Dr. Haber gazed again at the mural and wondered when such a photograph had been taken. Blue sky, snow from foothills to peak. Years ago, in the 60s or 70s, no doubt, the greenhouse effect had been quite gradual, and Haber, born in 1962, could clearly remember the blue skies of his childhood. Nowadays, the eternal snows were gone from all the world's mountains, even Everest, even Erebus, fiery-throated on the waste Antarctic shore. But of course, they might have colored a modern photograph, faked the blue sky and white peak, no telling.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Orr," he said, rising,
smiling, but not extending his hand, for many patients these days had a strong dread of physical contact. The patient uncertainly withdrew his almost proffered hand, fingered his necklace nervously, and said, "How do you do?" The necklace was the usual long chain of silvered steel, clothing ordinary, office worker standard, haircut conservative shoulder length, beard short, light hair and eyes, a short, slight, fair man, slightly undernourished, good health, 28 to 32. Unaggressive, placid, milquetoast, repressed, conventional. The most valuable period of relationship with a patient, Haber often said, is the first 10 seconds.
"Sit down, Mr. Orr. Right. Do you smoke? The brown filters are Tranq's, the white are Denik's."
Orr did not smoke.
"Now let's see if we're together on your situation. HEU Control wants to know why you've been borrowing your friend's pharmacy cards to get more than your allotment of pep pills and sleeping pills from the auto drug, right? So they sent you up to the boys on the hill, and they recommended voluntary therapeutic treatment and sent you over to me for the therapy. All correct?"
He heard his own genial, easy tone, well calculated to put the other person at his ease, but this one was still far from easy. He blinked often. His sitting posture was tense. The position of his hands was over-formal, a classic picture of suppressed anxiety. He nodded as if he was gulping at the same moment.
"Okay, fine. Nothing out of the way there. If you'd been stockpiling your pills to sell to addicts or commit a murder with, then you'd be in hot water. But as you simply used them, your punishment's no worse than a few sessions with me. Now, of course, what I want to know is why you used them, so that together we can work out some better life pattern for you that'll keep you within the dosage limits of your own farm card, for one thing, and perhaps, for another, set you free of any drug dependency at all. Now, your routine.
His eyes went for a moment to the folder sent down from the med school.
Was to take barbiturates for a couple of weeks, then switch for a couple of nights to dextroamphetamine, then back to the barbiturates. How did that get started? Insomnia?
I sleep well.
But you have bad dreams?
The man looked up, frightened, a flash of open terror. He was going to be a simple case. He had no defenses.
Sort of, he said huskily. It was an easy guess for me, Mr. Orr. They generally send me to the dreamers.
He grinned at the little man.
I'm a dream specialist. Literally, an onryologist. Sleep and dreaming are my field. Okay, now I can proceed to the next educated guess, which is that you used the phenobarb to suppress dreaming, but found that with habituation the drug has less and less dream-suppressive effect until it has none at all. Similarly with the dexedrin, so you alternated them, right?
The patient nodded stiffly.
Why was your stretch on the dexedrin always shorter?
It made me jumpy.
I'll bet it did. And that last combination dose you took was a Lulu, but not in itself dangerous. All the same, Mr. Orr, you were doing something dangerous. He paused for effect. You were depriving yourself of dreams.
Again, the patient nodded.
Do you deprive yourself of food and water, Mr. Orr? Have you tried doing without air lately?
He kept his tone jovial, and the patient managed a brief, unhappy smile.
You know that you need sleep, just as you need food, water, and air. But did you realize that sleep's not enough? That your body insists just as strongly upon having its allotment of dreaming sleep? If deprived systematically of dreams, your brain will do some very odd things to you. It will make you irritable, hungry, unable to concentrate. Does this sound familiar? It wasn't just the dexedrin. Liable to daydreams, uneven as to reaction times, forgetful, irresponsible, and prone to paranoid fantasies. And finally, it will force you to dream no matter what. No drug we have will keep you from dreaming, unless it kills you. For instance, extreme alcoholism can lead to a condition called central pontine myelinolysis, which is fatal. Its cause is a lesion in the lower brain resulting from lack of daydreaming, not from lack of sleep, from lack of the very specific state that occurs during sleep, the dreaming state, REM sleep, the D state. Now, you're no alcoholic and not dead, and so I know that whatever you've taken to suppress your dreams, it's worked only partially. Therefore, A, you're in poor shape physically from partial dream deprivation, and B, you've been trying to go up a blind alley. Now, what started you up the blind alley? A fear of dreams. Of bad dreams, I take it. Or what you consider to be bad dreams. Can you tell me anything about these dreams?
Orr hesitated. Haber opened his mouth and shut it again. So often he knew what his patients were going to say, and could say it for them better than they could say it for themselves. But it was their taking the step that counted. He could not take it for them. And after all, this talking was a mere preliminary, a vestigial rite from the palmy days of analysis. Its only function was to help him decide how he should help the patient, whether positive or negative conditioning was indicated, what he should do.
I don't have nightmares more than most people, I think, Orr was saying, looking down at his hands. Nothing special. I'm afraid of dreaming. Of dreaming bad dreams?
Any dreams.
I see. Have you any notion how that fear got started? Or what it is you're afraid of, wish to avoid?
As Orr did not reply at once, but sat looking down at his hands, square reddish hands lying too still on his knee, Haber prompted just a little.
Is it the irrationality, the lawlessness, sometimes the immorality of dreams? Is it something like that that makes you uncomfortable?
Yes, in a way. but for a specific reason. You see, here's the crux, the lock, though Haber also watching those tense hands, poor bastard. He had wet dreams and a guilt complex about him, boyhood enuresis, compulsive mother. Here's where you stop believing me. The little fellow was sicker than he looked. A man who deals with dreams, both awake and sleeping, isn't too concerned with belief and disbelief, Mr. Orr. They're not categories I use much. They don't apply. So ignore that and go on. I'm interested. Did that sound patronizing? He looked at Orr to see if the statement had been taken amiss, and met, for one instant, the man's eyes. Extraordinarily beautiful eyes, Haber thought, and was surprised by the word, for beauty was not a category he used much either. The irises were blue or gray, very clear, as if transparent. For a moment, Haber forgot himself and stared back at those clear, elusive eyes, but only for a moment, so that the strangeness of the experience scarcely registered on his conscious mind. Well, Orr said, speaking with some determination, I have had dreams that affected the non-dream world, the real world. We all have, Mr. Orr. Orr stared, the perfect straight man. The effect of the dreams of the just pre-waking D-state on the general emotional level of the psyche can be... But the straight man interrupted him. No, I don't mean that. And stuttering a little. What I mean is, I dreamed something and it came true. That isn't hard to believe, Mr. Orr. I'm quite serious in saying that. It's only since the rise of scientific thought that anybody much has been inclined even to question such a statement, much less disbelieve it. Prophetic, not prophetic dreams. I can't foresee anything. I simply change things. The hands were clenched tight. No wonder the med school bigwigs had sent this one here. They always sent the nuts they couldn't crack to Haber. Can you give me an example? For instance, can you recall the very first time that you had such a dream? How old were you? The patient hesitated a long time and finally said, 16, I think. His manner was still docile. He showed considerable fear of the subject, but no defensiveness or hostility toward Haber. I'm not sure. Tell me about the first time you're sure of. I was 17. I was still living at home, and my mother's sister was staying with us. She was getting a divorce and wasn't working, just getting basic support. She was kind of in the way. It was a regular three-room flat, and she was always there. Drove my mother up the wall. She wasn't considerate, Aunt Ethel, I mean. Hogged the bathroom. We still had a private bathroom in that flat. And she kept, making a sort of joking play for me, half-joking, coming into my bedroom in her topless pajamas and so on. She was only about 30. It got me kind of uptight. I didn't have a girl yet and, adolescence. It's easy to get a kid worked up. I resented it. I mean, she was my aunt. He glanced at Haber to make sure that the doctor knew what he had resented and did not disapprove of his resentment. The insistent permissiveness of the late 20th century had produced fully as much sex guilt and sex fear in its heirs as had the insistent repressiveness of the late 19th century. Orr was afraid that Haber might be shocked at his not wanting to go to bed with his aunt. Haber maintained his noncommittal but interested expression, and Orr plowed on. Well, I had a lot of sort of anxiety dreams, and this aunt was always in them, usually disguised the way people are in dreams sometimes. Once she was a white cat, but I knew she was Ethel, too. Anyhow, finally, one night when she'd got me to take her to the movies and tried to get me to handle her, and then when we got home she kept flopping around on my bed and saying how my parents were asleep and so on, well, After I finally got her out of my room and I got to sleep, I had this dream, a very vivid one. I could recall it completely when I woke up. I dreamed that Ethel had been killed in a car crash in Los Angeles, and the telegram had come. My mother was crying while she was trying to cook dinner, and I felt sorry for her and kept wishing I could do something for her, but I didn't know what to do. That was all. Only when I got up, I went into the living room. No Ethel on the couch. There wasn't anybody else in the apartment, just my parents and me. She wasn't there. She never had been there. I didn't have to ask. I remembered. I knew that Aunt Ethel had been killed in a crash on a Los Angeles freeway 6 weeks ago, coming home after seeing a lawyer about getting a divorce. We had got the news by telegram. The whole dream was just sort of reliving something like what had actually happened. Only it hadn't happened. Until the dream. I mean, I also knew that she'd been living with us, sleeping on the couch in the living room until last night.
But there was nothing to show that, to prove it.
No, nothing. She hadn't been. Nobody remembered that she had been except me, and I was wrong, now.
Haber nodded judiciously and stroked his beard. What had seemed a mild drug habituation case now appeared to be a severe aberration, but he had never had a delusion system presented to him quite so straightforwardly, or might be an intelligent schizophrenic, feeding him a line, putting him on with schizoid inventiveness and deviousness. But he lacked the faint inward arrogance of such people, to which Haber was extremely sensitive.
Why do you think your mother didn't notice that reality had changed since last night?
Well, she didn't dream it. I mean, the dream really did change reality. It made a different reality, retroactively, which she'd been part of all along. Being in it, she had no memory of any other. I did. I remembered both. Because I was there at the moment of the change. This is the only way I can explain it. I know it doesn't make sense. But I have got to have some explanation, or else face the fact that I am insane.
No, this fellow was no milquetoast.
I'm not in the judgment business, Mr. Orr. I'm after facts. And the events of the mind, believe me, to me, are facts. When you see another man's dream as he dreams it recorded in black and white on the electroencephalograph, as I've done 10,000 times, you don't speak of dreams as unreal. They exist. They are events. They leave a mark behind them. Okay, I take it that you had other dreams that seem to have this same sort of effect?
Some. Not for a long time, only under stress, but it seemed to be happening oftener. I began to get scared.
Haber leaned forward.
Why?
Orr looked blank.
Why scared?
Because I don't want to change things,
Orr said, as if stating the super obvious.
Who am I to meddle with the way things go? And it's my unconscious mind that changes things without any intelligent control. I tried auto-hypnosis, but it didn't do any good. Dreams are incoherent, selfish, irrational, immoral. You said a minute ago they come from the unsocialized part of us, don't they? At least partly. I didn't want to kill poor Ethel. I just wanted her out of my way. Well, in a dream, that's likely to be drastic. Dreams take shortcuts. I killed her in a car crash 1,000 miles away 6 weeks ago. I am responsible for her death.
Haber stroked his beard again. Therefore, he said slowly, the dream suppressant drugs, so that you will avoid further responsibilities.
Yes, the drugs kept the dreams from building up and getting vivid. It's only certain ones, very intense ones, that are,
he sought a word,
effective.
Right. Okay. Now let's see. You're unmarried. You're a draftsman for the Bonneville-Umatilla Power District. How do you like your work?
Fine.
How's your sex life?
Had one trial marriage, broke up last summer after a couple of years.
Did you pull out or she?
Both of us. She didn't want a kid. It wasn't full marriage material.
And since then?
Well, there are some girls at my office. I'm not a great stud, actually.
How about interpersonal relationships in general? Do you feel you relate satisfactorily to other people? That you have a niche in the emotional ecology of your environment?
I guess so.
So that you could say that there's nothing really wrong with your life, right? Okay, now tell me this. Do you seriously want to get out of this drug dependency?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now, you've been taking drugs because you want to keep from dreaming. But not all dreams are dangerous, only certain vivid ones. You dreamed of your Aunt Ethel as a white cat, but she wasn't a white cat next morning, right? Some dreams are all right, safe.
He waited for Orr's assenting nod.
Now think about this. How would you feel about testing this whole thing out, and perhaps learning how to dream safely, without fear? Let me explain. You've got the subject of dreaming pretty loaded emotionally. You are literally afraid to dream because you feel that some of your dreams have this capacity to affect real life in ways you can't control. Now that may be an elaborate and meaningful metaphor by which your unconscious mind is trying to tell your conscious mind something about reality, your life, which you aren't ready, rationally, to accept. But we can take the metaphor quite literally. There is no need to translate it, at this point, into rational terms. Your problem at present is this. You're afraid to dream. And yet you need to dream. You tried suppression by drugs. It didn't work. Okay, let's try the opposite. Let's get you to dream intentionally. Let's get you to dream intensely and vividly right here, under my supervision, under controlled conditions, so that you can get control over what seems to you to have got out of hand.
How can I dream to order?
Orr said with extreme discomfort. In Dr. Haber's Palace of Dreams, you can. Have you been hypnotized?
For dental work.
Good. Okay, here's the system. I put you into hypnotic trance and suggest that you're going to sleep. That you're going to dream. And what you're going to dream. You'll wear a tran cap to ensure that you have genuine sleep, not just hypnotrance. While you're dreaming, I watch you, physically and on the EEG the whole time. I wake you, and we talk about the dream experience. If it's gone off safely, perhaps you'll feel a bit easier about facing the next dream.
But I won't dream effectively here. It only happens in one dream out of a dozen or hundreds.
Orr's defensive rationalizations were quite consistent. You can dream any style dream at all here. Dream content and dream effect can be controlled almost totally by a motivated subject and a properly trained hypnotizer. I've been doing it for 10 years, and you'll be right there with me because you'll be wearing a tran cap. Ever worn one?
Orr shook his head.
You know what they are, though.
They send a signal through electrodes that stimulates the brain to go along with it.
That's roughly it. The Russians have been using it for 50 years. The Israelis refined on it. We finally climbed aboard and mass-produced it for professional use in calming psychotic patients and for home use in introducing sleep or alpha trance. Now, I was working a couple of years ago with a severely depressed patient on OTT at Linton. Like many depressives, she didn't get much sleep and was particularly short of D-state sleep, dreaming sleep. Whenever she did enter the D state, she tended to wake up. Vicious circle effect. More depression, less dreams. Less dreams, more depression. Break it. How? No drug we have does much to increase D sleep.
ESB, electronic brain stimulation, but that involves implanting electrodes, and deep, for the sleep centers. Rather avoid an operation. I was using the TRANCAP on her to encourage sleep. What if you made the diffuse low-frequency signal more specific, directed it locally to the specific area within the brain? Oh, yes, sure, Dr. Haber, that's a snap. But actually, once I got the requisite electronics research under my belt, it only took a couple of months to work out the basic machine. Then I tried stimulating the subject's brain with a recording of brain waves from a healthy subject in the appropriate states, the various stages of sleep and daydreaming. Not much luck. Found a signal from another brain may or may not pick up a response in the subject. Had to learn to generalize, to make a sort of average out of hundreds of normal brainwave records. Then, as I work with the patient, I narrow it down again, tailor it. Whenever the subject's brain is doing what I want it to do more of, I record that moment, augment it, enlarge and prolong it, replay it, and stimulate the brain to go along with its own healthiest impulses, if you'll excuse the pun. Now, all that involved an enormous amount of feedback analysis, so that a simple EEG plus TRANCAP grew into this. And he gestured to the electronic forest behind Orr. He had hidden most of it behind plastic paneling, for many patients were either scared of machinery or over-identified with it, but still it took up about a quarter of the office. "That's the dream machine," he said with a grin. "Or, prosaically, the augmenter. And what it'll do for you is ensure that you do go to sleep and that you dream as briefly and lightly or as long and intensively as you like. Oh, incidentally, the depressive patient was discharged from Linton this last summer as fully cured." He leaned forward. "Willing to give it a try?"
"No."
"What do you want to wait for?"
"But I can't fall asleep at 4:30 in the afternoon." Then he looked foolish.
Haber had been digging in the overcrowded drawer of his desk and now produced a paper, the consent to hypnosis form required by HEW. Orr took the pen Haber held out, signed the form, and put it submissively down on the desk. "All right, good. Now tell me this, George. Does your dentist use a hypnotape, or is he a do-it-yourself man?"
"Tape. I'm 3 on the susceptibility scale."
"Right in the middle of the graph, eh? Well, for a suggestion as to dream content to work well, we'll want fairly deep trance. We don't want a trance dream, but a genuine sleep dream. The augmenter will provide that, but we want to be sure the suggestion goes pretty deep. So, to avoid spending hours in just conditioning you to enter deep trance, we'll use VC induction. Ever seen it done?"
Orr shook his head. He looked apprehensive, but he offered no objection. There was an acceptant, passive quality about him that seemed feminine or even childish.
Haber recognized in himself a protective bullying reaction toward this physically slight and compliant man. To dominate, to patronize him was so easy as to be almost irresistible. "I use it on most patients. It's fast, safe, and sure. By far the best method of inducing hypnosis, and the least trouble for both hypnotist and subject." Orr would certainly have heard the scare stories about subjects being brain damaged or killed by over-prolonged or inept VC induction, and though such fears did not apply here, Haber must pander to them and calm them, lest or resist the whole induction. So he went on with the patter, describing the 50-year history of the VC induction method, and then, veering off the subject of hypnosis altogether, back to the subject of sleep and dreams, in order to get Orr's attention off the induction process and on to the aim of it. "The gap we have to bridge, you see, is the gulf that exists between the waking or hypnotized trance condition and the dreaming state. That gulf has a common name, sleep, normal sleep, the S state, non-REM sleep, whichever name you like. Now, there are, roughly speaking, 4 mental states with which we're concerned, waking, trance, S-sleep, and D-state. If you look at mentation processes, the S-state, the D-state, and the hypnosis